Well, hello again to everyone. My name is Paul Weber, and it is my honor to welcome you to another Weber Training Teleclass. This one is The Building, a Source and Vector of Problematic Microorganisms. My colleague and the co-founder of Teleclass Education, Dr. Syed Sattar at the University of Ottawa, he suggested this topic, and he also suggested the speaker. Now, as you'll see in one of his first slides, Curtis White has been in microbiology for most of his life and is particularly interested in the study of environmental decontamination. He has published dozens of scientific papers and has addressed conferences around the world. Now, my usual disclaimer, I'll slide it in now. Teleclass Education does not support or advertise any particular company or product. And any mention of a brand name during the course of the teleclass is not to be taken as an endorsement. That said, I know Mr. White to be a real professional and a very experienced speaker, and I'm really confident that this will be time very well spent. So to bring us to teleclass, The Building, a Source and Vector of Problematic Microorganisms, it is my privilege to present Curtis White. Kurt.
Paul, thank you very much, and welcome everybody. Morning or afternoon, depending on where you are. And I think we'll have a nice session. I will be directing you two specific slides, but some of the text as I read through this will seem a little bit askew from that, but don't try to think that this is going to be some sort of a literal lecture going point by point from the slides. So if you'd look at slide two, welcome, sick building syndrome, nosocomial infections, black mold, drug-resistant microbes, Legionnaire's disease, hypersensitivity pneumonitis, all are part of the emotive and real problems caused by microbes associated with buildings. Buildings, hospitals, clinics, extended care facilities, offices, modern, new, old, or primitive, can all be part of the source and vector of problematic microorganisms. The consequences are multiple and reach every area of the medical facility and caregiving environment. This includes, slide three, the challenges that microbes cause in terms of insurance payments and insurance costs, the legislative mandates that are coming to us for reporting nosocomial infections, et cetera, the press events that put our medical care facilities on the front page, whether it's from MRSA to aspergillosis problems, the legal actions that come from these that include an unending array of malpractice and other types of suits that, again, cost our medical care systems enormous amounts of money. The fact that we live in buildings that are real buildings and the deferred maintenance budgets are a real part of sometimes the causative things that lead to the environments that our microbes live in. And the fact that we live in a day where reduced housekeeping staffs challenge our ability to do the hygienic practices that we know are needed. As Paul introduced, I'm going to go to slide four. I'm Kurt White. I'm a microbiologist and biochemist. I've had an unusual career in that I began working in Dow Chemical's Antimicrobial Technical Service Lab in 1962 as a college co-op, a classic lab rat, cleaning test tubes, etc. But I got bit by the bug of really enjoying and loving this area of science, and my 50-plus patents and over 200 trade and professional publications are part of my path here today to speak with you. I offer this not to impress you with my luck at being able to find and stay in a profession for my total working career, but to validate the wacky view that I'm able to take in bringing the science and the practical world of microbes in buildings to your attentions. With our subject today, The Building as a Source and Vector of Problematic Microorganisms, my manual on slide five is kind of what I'm using as a guide to take you through this this world. We could approach the microbial problems in buildings from an academic perspective and throw about names of microbes and quote learned people from around the world, but that's no fun when we can instead take a practical look at the microbial habitats within a building and their impact on the building itself and the occupants. This will be the practical world that you, your facilities, and housekeeping environmental services people live and work in each day. Whether you're a clinic or a 10-story research hospital, slide 6, you work very hard to balance the indoor environmental quality and the microbial habitats and their impact. For those of you that are directly or indirectly dealing with infection control, I hope to take you beyond your first tier of concerns with personal hygiene, your second tier of concern with garments, linens, cubicle curtains, surgical drapes, and other soft goods, to a third tier of concern for microbial problems when we look at the building as a source and vector of microbes. Slide 7. Come with me and follow a practicing microbiologist with over 43 years of experience as he takes you into this wacky world of wee beasties in buildings. Well, maybe not so wacky, but we've got an hour together, so let's enjoy it. And as we look at these good, bad, and the ugly of microbes in buildings. Buildings are built for human habitation, for comfort, for productivity, shelter, security, for, in the medical sense, a healing environment, and we certainly want that building to follow our axiom of do no harm. Slide 8. The problems of microorganisms in buildings are real, and the understanding of these their presence and impact by you, the practitioners, and your management is not generally good. These organisms in your building environment affect you all and the jobs that you are challenged each day to perform. Having an understanding of the habitats and habits of these organisms will help you remove them from the nosocomial infection risk factors. We know that the impact on healthcare goes beyond morbidity and mortality and simple discomfort, but it also to the actual utility of the building, to the maintenance costs, to the exposure of staff, to actual outcomes, to lost time, and to infection reportables. The serious element of this is that microbes, for all of the good that they do, when they are out of balance or in the wrong place at the wrong time, they are a problem to people, products, and buildings. They cause morbidity and mortality in people, problems to buildings and their operating systems, and destruction and life cycle losses to products produced in buildings. For those of you in the healthcare profession, from infection control, housekeeping, or environmental services, maintenance, administration, employee relations, or hospital communication specialists, the health of your facility is the baseline for the health of your employees, the patients, visitors, and how you are held accountable. If you just simply step back from your everyday life and think about it, the environment around you is for the most part an unknown quantity and one that on inspection is filled with microbial habitats. These habitats in their diversity offer sources, amplification sites, and routes of transmission for an array of microorganisms. For some surfaces, you would not tolerate conditions where microbes could live, amplify, or be transmitted. Someplace in your training or your common sense, you would not have an operating table or arena physically dirty or work there without some forms of disinfection or sanitization. The area where you eat in your medical setting will be cleaned and disinfected, the bathrooms, the intensive care areas, and many other at-risk areas. Why do you do this in these obvious microbial habitats and totally ignore other areas of the building, the operating systems, and the furnishings? I think that it's because your job functions are so focused on the here and now that to step back and understand the building and its impact on the effectiveness and cost of healthcare just doesn't happen. We stay ignorant until we learn something new, or we are forced to think about the unknown spaces, the microbial habitats of a building, and assess the risk from those organisms that are found there in these diverse environments. I use the example sometimes that schools are in fact in the business of educating children. They aren't in the buildings business, and so often the buildings are ignored. This can hold true in the healthcare setting also. The risk associated with microbes slaps us in the face when we have a Legionella outbreak, when there are people affected by hypersensitivity pneumonitis, when people suffer allergenic responses, when we chase MRSA or VRS all over the facility, or when immunosuppressed patients or visitors come down with aspergillosis and die. But the rest of the time, the building environment is out of sight and out of mind. The invisible spaces of the building are not invisible to microbes, and when conditions are right, they amplify and become part of the occupied space and enter the potential infectious zones. Slide 9. Microbes cause a myriad of problems. There are real costs and there are hidden costs. There are press events. There's the distraction of resources when you have a microbial event. There's the litigation that comes with it, the political backlash, and the ever-present accountabilities. When we discuss nosocomial infections or hospital-acquired infections, we can debate the merits of hand washing. We can discuss the benefits of using disinfectants or sanitizers. We can debate the risk associated with sublethal doses of disinfectants when proper use is not done, and its link to resistant microorganisms. But get real. The debate doesn't trump your mother, your parent, that taught you some version of cleanliness is next to godliness. I love to tell people that my mother was the best indoor environmentalist ever. We washed the walls in our house twice a year. We beat the rugs outdoors. We practiced good home and personal hygiene, or else. This reality, and all of this is very good, but when it comes to microbes, clean, clean, clean doesn't work. And then disinfect, disinfect does not work. We need to use better tools and better science. Slide 10. This is particularly striking because we don't choose who comes into our buildings. The immunosuppressed, the sick, the young, the old, all levels of stressed people that live with their personal genetics, nutritional habits, hygiene habits, and an unending array of uncontrolled risk factors. Also, because we do have an ever-expanding array of drug-resistant infectious organisms, MRSA, VRS, flesh-eating strep, SARS, bird flu now, the whole array of existing and emerging prions, and other biocontaminants, natural or introduced. We need an awareness and strategy for control of indoor microbial contaminants. Leeuwenhoek, Pasteur, Lister, Koch, Semmelweis, and others have fought the battles of infection with common sense, not with statistics and studies and cost containment evaluations. So please bring with me on this tour your common sense. The time-tested equation of dose, virulence, and susceptibility still and will always hold true whether the source, dose, or transmission route is a person, water, air, or a building. Every time there is a study of note on the linkage of sources of microbes in the healthcare environment to disease, the results show positive linkage. From air filters with aspergillus linked to deaths in Children's Hospital in Boston, to the infamous Legionnaires' disease, from bacteria in an HVAC system, the environment seen and unseen is involved in the rates of infection equation, and they can be dealt with common sense and good practices, but not without knowledge. Today we will look at microbial contaminants in indoor environments. Slide 11. Bacteria, fungi, algae, and other microorganisms are a natural and inevitable part of our indoor environment. Homes, schools, offices, factories, hotels, hospitals, and farm buildings are loaded with a wide variety of these microorganisms. Throughout history, these organisms have played a significant role in the deterioration of materials, biocorrosion, biofouling, staining, rotting of foods, and disease in humans, animals, and plants. Recent events have brought a new focus on the dynamics of these microorganisms and their impact on human activity and health. In the early 1970s, the term Legionnaire's disease became a part of everyone's vocabulary, linking buildings to disease in a very direct way. To microbiological professionals, the negative role of microorganisms to building materials, furnishings, and human health and productivity was well understood, but it was out of sight and out of mind to the mainstream public. This awareness of buildings as a source of microbiological problems provided a new basis for understanding the rash of building-related illness and sick building syndrome cases that emerged. The seriousness of the problems caused by microbiologically contaminated surfaces and indoor air is evident by the necessary closings of schools, courthouses, and other buildings, as well as the ever-broadening impact on human health and building operations and materials. These problems occur throughout the world, and the authors, myself and my staff, are familiar with and have been consulted on problems in numerous states in the U.S., Bermuda, Puerto Rico, Canada, Singapore, India, and a number of European countries. All of the building, the exterior and interior, are involved. Slide 12. We look carefully at this slide, and we can see that if we look first at the building is made up of this roof, this envelope, these materials of construction and the architectural design, but it's influenced by all of the things around it, the weather patterns, the surrounding buildings and activities, and the topography of the land in that area. All of these are important because these are set the basis for moisture movement and for air pollutant movement that sets the tone for the indoor environment in slide 12, where we see that really in the indoor environment we're talking about the air itself, the surfaces, the air handling system, the water, and the people in slide 13. Other pollutants are part of the indoor air quality mix and cannot be ignored, but we mention them here only so that we don't confuse these things with the causative agents and the problems that microbes cause. In the same way, there are many other factors that affect indoor air quality and human interface. If you look at slide 14, we know that there are particulates. We've all been aware of asbestos, but common dust, paper dust, fibers, and the problems with lead in indoor environments. We know that there are radon problems on slide 15 in many locations around the world, especially hard rock areas. We know that they're looking at slide 16, that there are an array of volatile organic compounds that influence the health and productivity of people in indoor environments. We know also on slide 17 that there are these other factors that affect human comfort and health, these associated factors like light, humidity, temperature, ventilation, and noise, and occupant activity. These all influence it, but over the top of all of that in slide 18 are the microbes. And the microbes have impact on the building, the humans, and the business activities. And look at slide 19. Microorganisms are part of our everyday lives. Bacteria, fungi, yeast, and algae are found wherever moisture, temperature, food sources, and receptive surfaces allow. In the indoor environment, this includes virtually all structural and furnishing surfaces. Some of these organisms are beneficial and are a natural part of the environment. Others can and do cause health problems, ranging from simple discomfort to physical irritation, allergic sensitization, toxic response, disease, as well as destruction of building materials and products. Microbes are not as simple as the whole intact organisms tested in the laboratory. Microbial body, somatic parts, reproductive parts, spores, and metabolic products, gases, and chemicals, play a role in human well-being, comfort, health, and productivity, in manufacturer's product quality, and in the building's life and utility. Microorganisms are the only pollutant that manifests all the key forms of pollutants, particulates, gases, and infectious biologicals. They are particularly potent in that they reproduce in a very short time, as well as cause the full breadth of discomfort, irritation, sensitization, toxic reaction, and infectious disease. All of these are associated with indoor environmental quality problems and affect the healthcare environment. Given moisture, nutrients, receptive surfaces, and acceptable growth conditions, microorganisms can multiply from one organism to more than a billion in just 18 hours. There are clearly many reasons to consider microorganisms as the most prevalent and potent indoor environmental pollutant. Slide 20. The business problems are very real. We know that we lose occupants in office buildings. We have insurance costs that go up. Building owners actually lose value in their property. We know that there's productivity losses, that it increases worker compensation activities and costs. It changes the need for renovations. If you get a musty carpet or a fungus growing on a ceiling tile, things have to be changed out, and all of that costs in time and money and exposure. And we know that it costs energy costs because of the practices we do to control microbial problems in a traditional sense, and we know that it affects our maintenance costs. Slide 21. The medical impact of microorganisms on an individual depends on the genetic makeup and general health of the person, the physical and mental stress factors of the person's life, and the exposure and potency of the specific organism or group of organisms. Work or other psychological pressures, diet, weather patterns, and other environmental factors and pollutants contribute to the severity and duration of human reactions. For those people with a predisposition for respiratory problems, the infirm, elderly, babies, people recovering from illness, those with allergies and asthmatic conditions, and those being treated with immunosuppressed drugs or that are under unusual stress, the need to minimize contact with microorganisms and other biogenic materials is magnified. As a group, these at-risk people represent 30 to 60% of the population. Besides these at-risk people, current research in the U.S., Canada, and Europe clearly shows that microbial contaminants directly affect the productivity of workers and that they are the major contributors to the phenomena that we call sick building syndrome. Slide 22. To reiterate, we lose occupants, we have increased insurance costs, we can lose value in our property, we increase the cost of compensations, we increase the cost of energy and maintenance costs. For our adventure into this world of buildings, we need to take a little bit of a tour. The mental perspective is that we are looking for those microbial habitats that might be amplification sites or routes of transmission into the at-risk human contact zone. Okay, think about that again then. The mental perspective is that we're looking for those microbial habitats that might be amplification sites or routes of transmission into that at-risk human contact zone. Every building has a character and a history. Before deciding where to find or sample for problem microorganisms or set up a cleanup or prevention strategy, a basic understanding of the building and its use is helpful. The type and extent of sampling, remediation, or protection is quite different for a hospital than it is for an office building, a school, a hotel, or a manufacturing plant. Slide 23. The building can be thought of as a biosphere. The organisms are in constant state of flux. nutrient and humidity changes, and alteration of life-limiting toxic surfaces allow microbes to adjust to and often adapt to these ever-changing conditions in their environment. A building undergoes constant change as it progresses through its life cycle. Microbial contamination, in a varied but inevitable way, will occur at different stages of this life cycle and can be manifested in many different ways. If you look at slide 24, what this slide represents is the microbial populations on the left axis and time going through on the bottom. And as a building ages, certain things happen to the microbial population. And we've studied and published on these biological dynamics. But in the beginning, there's a natural resistance of materials to microbial growth. There are a lot of different pH reasons and even chemical preservative reasons that that's true. As a building gets older, and by the way, the mix of organisms that we find at that stage is very much like the outdoors. So there's a great variety of microorganisms that we encounter, with no particular dominant species. What happens as the building ages, there becomes a sameness to that building. All the same people are there, the same processes, the same pollutants, and you set up in the same environmental conditions. This sets up conditions where the microbes population starts to specialize a little bit. And so now we get larger numbers of microbes, but fewer numbers of species. And we start to get some specialized dominant organisms. In the case where we have a sick building, it exceeds this line as illustrated, and we end up with a very high number of organisms and a very low number of species types. That stage of a building, when you have that dominant species, people are being exposed to that same group of proteins, that same group of spores, all the time when they're at their work. And those are the stages where we see sick buildings occurring. We see people with allergic responses flagging out. Every element of a building, its furnishings and the people within, offer homes for and become sources of microorganisms. Microorganisms need moisture and nutrients and grow associated with surfaces. Moisture can come from a leaky roof, a sweaty pipe, a leaky radiator, condensation on windows, humidified air from the HVAC system, landscaping, gutters, and direct condensation on and direct water into or under the building. Unvented combustion appliances or any number of other environmental and human sources. Problems at a hotel or resort facility are compounded by moisture from pools, spas, individual air conditioners, doors and windows left open by their guests, and literally hundreds of bathrooms. In an atmosphere not too different from our medical communities, except it's not quite the same relaxing environment, in an atmosphere where you have 40 to 70% relative humidity, most type of microorganisms can grow and reproduce. Nutrients can be organic material, inorganic material, and or living tissue. For example, bacteria play an important role as part of the body's microflora, and along with skin are shed continuously. Given acceptable growth conditions, some types multiply into these billions of organisms in within 18 to 24 hours. The great variety of microorganisms are everywhere and includes surfaces from the size of walls to the size of dust particles. Slide 25. A building may be infested during construction from the environment and or materials of construction and from catastrophic events, particularly fungal contaminations, but more commonly, the microorganisms are brought into the building by its occupants or air infiltration routes. Fungi, mold, mildew, and yeast enter the building on clothing, are wafted in through open doors, or are pulled in as makeup air by the HVAC system. Bacteria follow these same routes, but are primarily associated with human carriers and with very wet areas such as drain pans and areas where intermittent or standing water exists. Under normal conditions, the HVAC system chases and elevator shafts typically are not ideal growth sites for microorganisms, but are extremely efficient at transporting odors and airborne microorganisms from other growth sites throughout the building. Also, with the almost universal use of air conditioning, recycling of indoor air to improve energy efficiency takes place. This recycling tends to concentrate indoor air pollutants, including microbes. This is why in high-risk areas or a medical facility, once through air is often called for. After a high moisture event, such as a flood, leak in the roof, a break or rupture of a pipe, or breakdown of the HVAC system, chases, above ceiling plenums, elevator shafts, and bottom floor wells can become sites for growth of microorganisms that are typically overlooked or ignored during initial cleanup efforts. Subsequent drying of these wetted areas can force the overloaded microbial growth into stasis until the next moisture event, sometimes several years later, reactivates this prolific growth of microorganisms and the problems they cause. During the dryout phase, microorganisms, especially fungi, enter a rapid stage of reproduction and a bloom of spores that can overwhelm samplers and increase exposure to the occupants and other areas of the building. Slide 26. So let's investigate a little bit the cause of mold and mildew growth. 27. We know that we need nutrients for them. We know we need proper temperature ranges. We need moisture, and we need receptive surfaces. I often will cite the fact that if the conditions in a building are suitable for people, they're suitable for our microbe friends. And I think that makes, passes our test of common sense. So why are they here? Lots of contributing factors that give us a chance to take a short tour of the building. These contributing factors that allow microbes to be present include, slide 28, the building shell and the structure. They include the operating system, slide 29. They include appliances and equipment. They include pets and plants. We'll just go through these next series of slides. They include the occupants' habits and practices. They include cleaning procedures and equipment. And they include maintenance practices. They include energy-saving practices. And they focus us in on or they become exaggerated when we have catastrophic events. And that takes us up through slides 36. Slide 37. The need for detecting problem microorganisms in a building usually begins in a response to a complaint from one or more of the building occupants, slide 40, suffering from one more of the symptoms listed that we had listed above, or from the discovery of moldy or deteriorating areas in the building, especially after a moisture event. The complaints and or discovery can encompass entire buildings or be limited to individual workstation areas. Often such areas are out of sight and out of mind in hidden areas of the building, above ceiling spaces, inner walls, subfloors, chases, etc. Interviews of the affected occupants and information gathering strategies, including close observation of the affected areas, should be conducted to identify the cause of the problems. So once that problem is reported, let's follow through from slide 40 with slide 41. we need to be able to determine, is it just a certain room? Is it one side of a building? Can we use the outlets or switch plates on the walls so that we can get some sense of what's inside the wall? Can we look at the door or window jams and see if we have stains of fungal growth or soiling? And if we had the benefit of having a particle counter, we could actually see if there were particles coming from those areas that might be suspect spores. Do we have the complaint associated with a particular floor? Is it a below grade area, like a basement, where we know there are going to be different water events and condensation phenomena going on? Was the complaint near a pipe or electrical chase? These are these holes, these chases are these holes that go between floors of a building that the pipes and electrical things go through. Could it be near a stairwell or an elevator shaft where you get chimney effects of blowing of air and transport of microbes from one area to another? And when we really get a complaint, it's really critical to talk to the maintenance personnel and to the housekeeping people to help us understand the location of that complaint and its potential to be a habitat for different microbes. Slide 42. It also helps us when we can determine, is the complaint consistent with a particular time of day or time of week or time of year, after a rain or some other environmental event? The importance of this is that the building does change depending on those events or times of day, and they also, which also changes the microbiological habitats. And we know that, for example, that as you go through a work day, the carbon dioxide levels build up in areas. Is that a complicator to someone being more sensitive to some microbial contaminant that's in the environment? And you have to be able to ask all of these good questions so that we can source and find out, why is that complaint coming from a particular area of the building? Slide 44. Detection also begins with a broad view of the building structure and its dynamics. Movement of people, operation parameters of the building, ventilation systems and their interactions with different areas of the building. Outside influences such as recent or current weather conditions, outside air movement and its effect on the building pressurization, etc., which affects how microbes move about in the building. And the tools and methods of detection are varied and are beyond the scope of what we'll talk about today, but are very, very important. And it's something that is changing day to day as the knowledge of detection of microbes in indoor environments is increasing. The microorganisms that are detected in air, water, and surfaces, the term bioaerosols or biologically derived airborne contaminants describes these airborne particles that are living or originate from living organisms. Bioaerosols include microbes in their fragments, toxins, and particulate waste products, including the VOCs, and a variety of living things. They vary greatly over time by quantity and type in any given building or environment. Therefore, detection becomes more of an art than a science because no single technique is entirely reliable, and sampling results often become difficult to interpret. Choices of collection methods, transport, storage, media used for identification, the techniques and methods of identification. For those of you that are microbiologists, you know what a zoo this is as we try to focus on trying to find environmental organisms and how they interact with people. This is especially true for microorganisms where the utility of any technique depends on its use by a professional who has a thorough understanding of the sample site and the resident organisms, especially the target organisms. There are four basic reasons for testing for the presence of microorganisms in indoor environments. One, to establish a baseline of current conditions in a building that is experiencing no reported problems. These baseline data are very, very important to us. Number two, to indicate locations and migration routes of the organisms in a building. So it's sleuthing to help find out where they are and where they can move to. Number three, to determine the presence of specific health-related organisms. If you know you have a disease event, a sick building event, you can target the organism you're looking at and or looking for and have a better chance of finding any environmental sourcing of that organism. And number four, to evaluate the effectiveness of cleanup, mitigation, and our protective strategies. So we know that we can identify these spots, but then we have to have methods that make us confident that we've actually cleaned them up also. So baseline surveys of buildings used for normal occupancy allow for long-term tracking of microbial contaminants and the indication of domination by one or more organisms. We have found this absolutely critical that we don't just try to understand the numbers of organisms that are present in an environment, but also whether or not there's a good mix of types, just like that slide we had on succession, and whether or not there are dominant species. So slide 47. A building can be viewed as a giant box with top, sides, and bottom, and filled with furnishings, occupants, and connections, openings to the outside. The one truism that must be understood by anyone investigating for sites of microorganisms in buildings is that a wall is not just a wall, and a floor is not just a floor. Each of these entities is a multi-layered system. If you look at slide 48 and you see the general concerns for the indoor environment, you have the air handling system, and you have the occupants with all of their friendly microflora and their habits and practices that contribute to the microbiological environment. But what we like to focus on, again, are sources, replication, amplification sites, and then the pathways that the organisms can move. So if you have a problem area, you can focus on those things in that problem area. No more is this true than when we look at slide 49, 50, and 51. And as I stated, a floor isn't a floor. It is this, in fact, very complicated system. And you can imagine any of the constructions in your building. And when you have a microbiological event or you're trying to prevent a microbiological event, you must view these systems much like these illustrations, 49, 50, and 51, show. It's very important to be able to understand the microbial habitats for your particular materials of construction and construction techniques. We could spend, an hour in itself talking about these different areas, and yet I think that the basic concept that I certainly want to leave you with of all of these different habitats is well served just by looking at those slides. But if we move to mitigation and prevention strategy, slide 52, the search for indoor pollutants takes one to every area of a building, to every process, and to every occupant. We found the enemy. Now what do we do? Some of the contributing factors, causes, and sources of sick building syndrome and building-related illness have been identified, and many of the infinite ways that various pollutants affect our lives have been explored. We offer a guide here to effective control of the overwhelming array of microbial pollutants that are a real factor in the health of the building. As stated previously, control begins with identification of the problem pollutants, slide 53. You really have to agree with those people that are being affected as to what quality of air do we need. You have to understand how this influences the owner and the cost of operation. We need to come to agreement that we want a certain level of building hygiene and that we are going to invest in attaining it and maintaining it as well as monitoring it. And look at 54. Because the realities of our microbes is that there's a natural buildup that occurs, and then there are things that happen under catastrophic situations, and we have some tools available that we can use as preventatives. If we look at slide 55, the natural buildup of microorganisms, this can be caused by housekeeping practices or maintenance practices, but they are going to occur. And what we have to be able to do, what you are challenged with, is to set up programs where you can recognize when you need to intervene to the degree that you don't have to wait until there's a human outcome that causes that. We know that when there's a catastrophic event, slide 56, that we need a contingency plan of how to deal with this, much as we have a contingency plan for if there's a fire. These catastrophic water events, the contingency plan has to go further than just drying it out and rebuilding things and cleaning them up. You have to think of the microbiological consequences. It's very wise in a medical facility to have, as part of your reaction team, to have the infection control people be part of any reconstruction or construction that could go on. In slide 57, the contingency plan is an extremely important thing, but you need to be able to recognize when a professional help from outside needs to be brought in to help. Because we are challenged on slide 58 in our environment with the reality that there are no standards for these microbes in the environment. And we tend to try to lead people to this ALARA, that what we need to do is to go as low as reasonably achievable. And reasonable means cost effective. So depending on slide 59, whether we have light, medium, or heavy contamination, whether the area, slide 60, is a large, medium, or small area, we need to define the strategy with how we would deal with it. We know, too, that the location involved, if there's a risk of spread to areas where there's an at-risk population or where there's a risk to workers, we need to set up, slide 62, a general cleaning schedule or a full containment. All of this should be part of the contingency plan. These strategies for control really revolve on slide 63, revolve around the control of nutrients, the control of moisture, the control of sources. And if you look at slide 64, it's a little bit complicated, but I offer that after the talk, take a few minutes to just let yourself walk through that. Because when we have a microbial source, we need to consider whether we're just going to tear it out and what kind of protections we need for that, or are we going to try to control it in place with containment and cleanup and both source and amplification control. All of this leads us to mitigation type strategies, slide 65, where we want to move to full isolation, full containment, and moving towards elimination of the microbial contaminants, slide 66. And again, we must fully consider the areas that are at risk, the after cleanup checks and testing that we would do, and how do we deal with new construction areas in the buildouts, because we need to employ the best of our technologies to deal with those areas. Slide 67 expresses some things, and again, I'll leave it to you to go through this trail of logics after the talk. But slide 67, 68, and 69 talk about some of the experiences that we've had in dealing with our technologies in being part of the prevention strategies that can be used to deal with microbial problems in indoor environments. Taking us to slide 70. The first defense is a good offense. A baseline audit of each building is necessary for comparison if an emergency arises. The audit can consist of a simple audit of the building materials, operating systems, furnishings, and the processes used in a building. Or it can include actual measurements of suspect particulates, VOCs, and the microbes. This can be done for old buildings, buildings under construction, or even back in the design and specification stages of a building's life. Under certain circumstances, it may also be valuable to have an audit of the occupants and staff. At the New York Stock Exchange, because that building is so critical, not only has every mitigation and prevention strategy been put in place, but they actually use all of the immunization techniques available to try to protect the workers. It's the first defense is a good offense. And that may be a bit extreme for normal buildings, but not for those guys. The forms and formats for such audits are available from some government authorities and some service companies. It's very important that the as-built plans are available. Most of us don't deal in the building environment all the time, but the blueprints and the specifications that were used to set the building up, they change. And building people call that the as-builts. And in most constructions, it's fairly well demanded that any changes that occur get on the blueprints. This is important because that sets the tone for how you're going to find the habitats where these organisms live and can be causing problems. It's very important that the as-built plans are available and that the specification documents on operation of the air handling system are kept up to date. As important as the building audit is, it's equally important to get a clear definition of the intended purpose of the building, and in the case of what you're challenged with in a medical facility is what are the individual areas of the building going to be used for? Because that sets the standard for the microbiological control that you want for those areas. In summary of all of this, good records, common sense, and compliance with regulations and standards, and involving all of the pertinent people on a prevention and solutions team will help to minimize problems associated with indoor environmental quality. The role of microorganisms is paramount, and their control must be a major target for anyone trying to eliminate the real and potential indoor environmental problems in our modern buildings. For those of you in the medical profession, it is critical to establish a working group, a team that is responsible for monitoring microbial problems to the occupants, building materials, and operating systems, and for establishing and keeping up-to-date building and infrastructure status and problems records. Our critical steps are define the sources of the microbes, define the routes of transmission of the organisms, and determine by which means and routes they are transported from one area of the building to another, and whether that's a dirty clothes hamper or a person walking down a hall or the air handling system. Define the variety of organisms and determine the dominant species that are present. Determine the numbers of organisms that are normal so that you can tell when it's abnormal. Provide that baseline of organisms for numbers and types of organisms. Provide for comparisons of sites to outdoor and indoor reference sites. If you have a problem area, say an office area where people are complaining, you want to go to an office area where people aren't complaining and make comparisons of the microbial profile from the air samples and from the surfaces. provide for a presumptive understanding of the organisms, and provide for confirmatory definition of the organisms. We often do rather casual morphological identifications of microbes, but if in fact we're having a health event, it's good to do confirmatory tests. We really set our sights on cleaning up any problems that are seen, we kill the organisms, and we set up a preventative strategies. Thanks all for your attention and good hunting. I did include in the slides some case histories of some particularly problem hospital settings where both for catastrophic and natural buildup reasons there were microbial problems and how they were able to be dealt with. I just came back from Malaysia where they've just reopened a 10-story hospital that was closed, and I think you'll find some of that of interest. I hope this was helpful, and best to you all.
Well, thank you very much, Curtis. This has indeed been very helpful. You've obviously been thinking about this sort of thing for more than 1 or 2 years.
True.
How long has this whole, I'm going to call it building hygiene, this whole indoor environmental movement been happening? Is this fairly recent?
Well, you know, in some ways it is. I happened to be in graduate school at Wayne State University when Pontiac fever came about, and that was the trigger organism that led us to the understanding of Legionnaires' disease as it came in the early 70s. So I was very fortunate to be on the cusp of all, or at the beginning of all of this, because I think that was the first real big red flag. Even though there were hypersensitivity pneumonitis and aspergillosis cases that were clearly linkable before that, that was the trigger that really brought at least the scientific community to understanding how this involvement came. The public health industry, I think, kind of got slapped upside the head as we've looked at these black mold, sick building things, and realized that these weren't chemical contaminants. In fact, they were our microbiological friends. And so we've, since that early 70s, it's kind of escalated to now where there's a press event every day, and we know that a lot of the traditional antimicrobial tools that we've used lead to microbial resistance and to adapted microbes. And so we've had to get smarter and smarter about the strategies we use for controlling these organisms, and that's a whole other talk all by itself, but it would be a fun one too. And I understand the challenge that you practitioners out there are dealing with every day, and I hope this is insightful.
One whole new level of things to be worried about. Thank you for that. Thank you all for joining the teleclass today, and a special thanks to Curtis White for his very interesting presentation. Until we meet again, everyone, goodbye.